Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 2nd, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week we sample meads from home mead maker Mike Lozano of Aurora, Colorado. That's near Denver. Mike treated Steve Wilkes and me to samples of a few of his mead flavoring experiments, and we'll get tips from Mike along the way. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and some more advanced brewing techniques. But just a quick look into the mailbag for this week. Hank from Wichita, Kansas writes and says, "Greetings from the land of the Arkansas River." Apparently the Arkansas River gets a different pronunciation over there in Kansas. Hank says, "I've never brewed fermentable beverages, but I do roast my own coffee. So I guess I'm one of those folks that's never satisfied with the common fare. Since good beer is another of my passions, I've decided to learn home brewing." Congratulations, Hank. "My residence is a townhouse with an unprotected patio, so the possibility of intrusion by the young children playing about may banish my brewing activities to the indoors. So my wife and I are concerned about the brewing odor. I have not read any negative comments in the forums about brewing odor like I did on indoor coffee roasting odor, which can be quite offensive. I noticed that you filmed some of your video podcasts that looked like they were in your kitchen, so from that I'm thinking the odor may not be an issue." Well, Hank, the only time I've ever had problems relating to brewing smells was when my wife was pregnant with our first child. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast somewhere in the past 100 or so episodes. At that time, my wife was very sensitive to even moderate smells of any kind. So at that time, my brewing had to take kind of a back burner while she got over that being oversensitive. Otherwise, brewing beer inside is a treat to the senses, in my opinion at least. The steeping grains that you use tend to smell anywhere from roasty to biscuity and anywhere in between. And the malt extract, if you're an extract brewer, gives off a sweet, sometimes bready aroma. And then there are the hops, which are, of course, the biggest treat for me when I'm brewing is smelling those hops. When you put the hops into the boil, you know that you're making beer. That's when it goes from, that kind of smells like bread and grain, and you put the hops in there, it's like, oh, beer. And of course, you know, the aromas differ depending on the hop variety that you use. You know, you can get some that are spicy, some that are piney or fruity, or sometimes, you know, even a hint of mint in there somewhere, or citrusy smells coming out of your brew kettle when you're cooking in the kitchen there, when you're brewing in the kitchen. And some hops are so strong, especially if they're fresh, like some Simcoe pellets that I had the other day, they can act as a potpourri if you leave them in a bowl on your countertop. So fear not the smells of brewing, Hank. I think you'll find that they're wonderful. Now, there is one note. During fermentation, you may find some slightly off-putting odors coming out of your airlock as the yeast work through, you know, scrubbing some of the compounds out of your beer. You know, depending on the strain, you can get different smells. But it's not something that'll have the neighbors knocking on the door, I don't think. So don't worry about it. William from St. Louis heard the comments about brewing and CO2 and sent me a link to an article about New Belgium in Fort Collins, Colorado. Of course, you've seen them on our brewery tour on Basic Brewing Video. You've heard interviews with Peter Buchart and Lauren Salazar and Eric Salazar, you know, on our this podcast, the audio podcast. Anyway, New Belgium apparently is working with a biofuels company to put their carbon dioxide to good use. New Belgium will, according to this article, send waste CO2 to a company called Solix Biofuels, and the CO2 will be pumped into a bioreactor to help grow algae. The algae will then be processed into biodiesel fuel. And according to this article, the algae can yield up to 10,000 gallons of biodiesel per acre, as opposed to 50 to 100 gallons per acre for soybeans. Now that's 10,000 gallons per acre for the algae, as opposed to 50 to 100 gallons for the soybeans. So that sounds like a good deal to me. So good for the New Belgium folks out there. And thanks to you for the link, William. Speaking of our basic brewing video podcast, be sure to check out our video tour of Sandlot Brewery on this week's episode. The Sandlot at Coors Field is a small brewery that's located at Coors Field, needless to say probably, in Denver, home of the Colorado Rockies, and it's owned by Coors. Now, you might think, well, why am I going to a Coors brewery? The beers that they make at Sandlot are far from the silver bullet beer that pays most of the bills for the rest of the corporation. So they have won lots of awards at the Great American Beer Festival, and we tasted some of their beers, and they're really good. So we'll run an audio interview with John Legnard of Sandlot probably next week. But in the meantime, check out the video tour. Should be out there now. And if John looks familiar, it may be because he was on the episode of Monster Garage, where they turned the fire truck into the mobile brewery. Okay, let's jump right into our interview segment for this week. The American Homebrewers Association is celebrating Mead Day this Saturday. And you can learn more about that at beertown.org. And I thought it'd be a fun tie-in to run this particular interview to observe Mead Day in our own special way. Mike Lozano is someone that I've met over email over time. We've corresponded back and forth mostly about mead making. Now, when Steve Wilkes and I headed out to Colorado for the National Homebrewers Conference, we took that opportunity to drop in on Mike one evening to sample his meads and to learn some tips and tricks. We had a lovely dinner with Mike, his wife Tanya, and their cute kids, Tiana and Jared. Tanya cooked up a delicious lasagna, and then we all sat down afterwards to get down to business of drinking meads. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. It's very happy to be on the show, and welcome to my humble abode.
And Tanya, we've had a wonderful lasagna this evening, and thank you very much. And Steve, you know, being the food connoisseur that he is, he's put his stamp of approval on it, and I agree as well.
Thank you.
Walk us through this first one, Mike. What are we drinking here?
So the first one we have here isn't really technically a mead at all. It is a agave nectar wine, which is made from agave nectar, water, and yeast. Very similar to a mead, but since it's not honey, it's technically not a wine. So I'm calling it agave nectar wine. This one started out at 1134, 1.134. The final gravity ended up at 1050, and so it's very, very sweet, but the color of it is almost completely clear. There's just a little bit of yellow tint to it, but it's very clear, very sweet. I added some acid blend to it to kind of offset the sweetness of it, but it's very sweet, and let's have a taste.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Well, I'm just blown away. The sweetness of it's just wonderful. But, you know, it's not over. It's not, I'm at a loss for words. It's really just very good.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it is sweet, but it's not a cloying sweet. Mm-hmm. It's not anything that you'd want to put on pancakes or anything. So.
No, not that therapy. But to be quite honest, before the acid blend was put in, it was very cloyingly sweet. So, many of the mead processes that I follow, you'll see some recipes that have acid blend in the recipe. But more recent thought around it has been that if you put acid blend in, it lowers the pH, mm-hmm. and it makes it harder for the yeast to work. So the theory is now is that you only add acid blend at the end if you need to, for personal taste. That way it doesn't interfere with the fermentation, but you get the flavor that you're looking for.
And agave is traditionally used in tequilas, is it not?
Agave is what they make tequila out of. They will ferment it much like this, but then what they'll do is then distill it and then either let it age out of oak or in oak, depending on what type of tequila they're making.
Mm-hmm. That's delicious.
Yes, and you know,
maybe it's just the power of suggestion, but I almost get a little tequila flavor, you know, just a little bitty bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you care for some salt and a lime?
I'm dying for some salt and a lime. If you get some chips and salsa, that'd be good too.
We have that, as a matter of fact, in queso as well.
Now, give us a little background on how you got into meads and, you know, how you got into experimenting with all these different ingredients.
So that's an interesting story, because the first...
I hope so.
Yes. So the first time I actually ran into homebrewing, I was visiting a friend in Houston, and he had these big plastic buckets out with these weird-looking plastic things on it, and I asked him, what is that? And he says, I'm making my own beer. And back then, this was back before, or just after Talia and I had gotten married. We didn't have any money. We were still in school. And I thought, that may be something I could be interested in someday. Then time goes on, and I'm living in Redmond. And we moved in with a friend of ours to help save some money. And he had a house, and he had a basement. And I thought, this would be the perfect opportunity. So I invested in a beginning kit, started making beer. Now, the first beer I made was actually a raspberry wheat, trying to make something that Tanya would like to drink, and it was marginally successful. and I used that term loosely. So I thought, I would really, you know, rather invest some time in this into something that maybe Tanya would like, but still stay on with the hobby. And I had read about mead. I had never tasted mead, and I didn't think I was going to have the patience for mead. And then I thought, well, this would be actually a really good exercise in learning patience. Or if you look at it from a different perspective, maybe this would allow me to do homebrewing and be a little bit more lazy. So there was a meadery in the Pacific Northwest called Ambrosia by Christie, which has since unfortunately been sold out and liquidated because she had children and couldn't continue on with the meadery. But it was actually the first mead I ever tasted. It actually tasted like honey. And I fell in love with that mead. And I decided, okay, I'm going to get some honey and try it out. So I found a local honey provider down in that area and read up all that I could and tried it out. And lo and behold, my first four batches, two actually were drinkable. And of that two batches, I have three bottles of one and two bottles of the other still down in my basement that are now 3+ years old that we're now saving because we cracked some bottles open or popped the corks on a few bottles once we moved here, and they were so fantastic that we don't want to waste it. I had actually considered putting that into a contest, but then I realized I would have to enter all the rest of my bottles into the contest just to have enough volume to enter, so... We're waiting off on that, and that's how I got into mead. Right after I had those batches done, we had to move out into an apartment again. The arrangement didn't work out, and I actually didn't get starting up again until this last summer when we moved here to the Denver, Colorado area, and I have a new basement that's all my own. And one of the first things I did is find a local supplier of honey and start right back up. And I'm so glad now because I have a wondrous variety of experiments and batches done, and I'm enjoying myself immensely.
Let's move on to the next one then. What have we got up next?
So the next one we're going to do is we're going to taste five different batches of the same base batch that were flavored five different ways. So what I think we're going to start with is we're going to start with the vanilla bean mead. So this was a 1 gallon batch. And there's some stuff floating around in that. That is because I did this with Sparkaloid. And unfortunately, it's very, very hard to siphon 1 gallon batch with Sparkaloid findings in the bottom. So we're going to pour this one very carefully, just enough to get a taste. But this batch had just a single vanilla bean in it. That's all it was, a 1 gallon batch with a single vanilla bean. This one, if I remember my tasting notes, let me look at my tasting notes now. And backtrack just a wee bit.
Now, if you're going to fine your mead, if you're going to clarify it,
right?
What are your choices? There's Sparkaloid and Bentonite.
Sparkaloid and Bentonite. There's also some liquid ones made from Selfish called Isinglass. It depends on what your theory is of mead. Now, my basic philosophy of mead is that time is the one key element to a great mead. I will only find a mead if I think or know that it's going to take a very, very, very long time to clear on its own. The alfalfa honey that I get here in Colorado, when you make a traditional mead from straight alfalfa honey, it tends to stay cloudy for a very long time. So I've used two clarifying agents with good success with my alfalfa mead, one being Sparkaloid. Sparkaloid is a hot mix substance. You mix with water and pour it into the mead hot. And it is, you do that after fermentation. And then recently, I used another substance called bentonite, which is like an inert clay that you actually mix up ahead of time and make it cold. And it turns into kind of a slurry. It looks really nasty, but it's really just really, it's inert. And that, we found, if you actually use that prior to fermentation, what will happen is it'll actually bind with the yeast, and it'll move with the yeast during fermentation and actually help the yeast stay floating during fermentation. But once fermentation is done, it coagulates and flocculates out really nicely. And I have an experiment down in my basement where I did a two-gallon batch, split it up into 2 1-gallon batches of just straight alfalfa, and used bentonite in one and left one without bentonite. And it's amazing to see how much more clear the bentonite batch is after just a month. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing, amazing product. So I'm probably going to start using that as a matter of course in all my traditional batches.
Yeah, I think Steve and I are the theory that time will do the trick of clarifying the meads.
Yeah, I think so.
Most of the advanced mead makers that I encounter on the internet, and the ones that I trusted because their methods work, they always say if you don't like the way a mead batch has come out, put it in a closet, forget it for 6 months, come back and check it again.
Yeah.
You'll be amazed at the difference it makes.
On my first batch of mead, I used a clarifying agent, and I wound up with a great deal of this kind of gelatinous sediment at the bottom of the carboy. And, you know, I loved that mead so much, and I thought, now there's you know, several bottles worth of mead that are gone. You know, I've got clearer mead, but then I've got the sediment stuff in the bottom that has robbed me of all this mead, so.
That depends on how good your racking techniques are.
Well, apparently they weren't very good.
Neither are mine on these 1 gallon batches. So this one was the first of the clover. This was clover honey. It started out at 11:45, and it wound up at 10:30 before flavoring. So this was the vanilla bean.
And this is one bean per
1 gallon batch.
Oh, that's very strong.
Steve is speechless.
I'm speechless. The vanilla notes on this are very nice. Very, very nice.
My theory, I have lots of theories, but I like when I'm flavoring a mead for the honey to be present, but to be a carrier for the flavor that you're bringing out. So you want to be able to taste both and not have one necessarily overwhelm the other. But this is a very strong vanilla. Mm-hmm. If I were doing a 5-gallon batch of this, I'd probably just use 4 beans to a 5-gallon batch. Mm-hmm. But this was the vanilla bean was cut in half, like you would when you're cooking, cut in half, opened and scraped.
Right.
And then the whole thing was just dumped into the mead for, I believe it was 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
For a 1-gallon batch.
Wow.
It's a lot like, it's the vanilla, obviously reminds me of vanilla ice cream. Mm-hmm. And it's very sweet. And, you know, obviously a dessert beverage.
I really like sweet meads. I'm fond of saying that many people have a sweet tooth. I have a fang. So I'm very much into sweet meads. Every once in a while I'll deviate and go off and try to do a drier mead, but I'm very much into sweet meads.
Very nice.
I'll cut for just a minute.
Tanya, do you have a favorite among all these?
Probably, but I couldn't tell you which one it was.
It may change from day to day. It would be for me, I think. So there are some that that don't pass the Tanya test?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's good. At least she's honest, you know.
Yes.
All right. Shall we move on to the next one?
You bet.
So this one I call my cheater Mellow Mel. Most Mellow Mels done the proper way use real fruit. This one was the same clover mead, because I fermented that first as a 5-gallon batch, and then split post-fermentation. This one, if I count up the additions, is a 1-gallon batch with 3 ounces of blueberry extract. And I added one in, let it sit, tasted it, added another ounce in, let it sit, tasted it, added another one in, decided it was okay, let it age. So this one, you'll see, I think, has, you know, if I remember correctly, has a really nice color to it. Mm-hmm. So I got this idea actually from your podcast, where I believe you used the black cherry.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me the idea, and I went down to the, it's a kind of a Whole Foods store, and this was the only flavor extract they had. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I guess that makes that decision for me. So cheers.
Oh, that's good. That's really nice. The blueberry notes are very nice. It's not as thick and sweet as the vanilla. It might be technically, I don't know, but to the way that I'm tasting it, it's just lovely.
So now you're right. There's something interesting about using adjuncts is that the adjuncts will add more than just flavor and color. They add texture to, as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of texture to the vanilla.
Yeah,
and I've used vanilla in other meads to actually bring not just so much the flavor, but that underlying texture to the batch to help meld all the rest of the flavors together. Mm. And that is the orange cinnamon vanilla mead that I've got down now bulk aging and clearing in the basement. Mm. So it has that had 4 vanilla beans in it with the cinnamon and the orange. So
yeah, the vanilla is really kind of a lower tones, I guess, if you're thinking of tasting in musical notes, you know. Mm-hmm. And this has the higher taste notes, in my opinion, if that makes sense.
I imagine the vanilla in the meats that I'm making downstairs is similar to why people use vanilla in chocolate ice cream.
Yeah.
Same kind of idea.
Mm. I could drink a lot of this.
That's my cheater Mellow Mel. So.
Very good.
What's up next?
So up next, the last 3 batches were flavored using, of all things, Tazo tea bags.
Hmm.
Now, I figured if I'm going to make a, that would be called what now? A spiced mead. That's a methlogen, I believe is how it's pronounced. And I figured, well, I could try to come up with my own spice blend, or I could cheat and use some that were already made. So I went down to the local Starbucks, and I was there for another reason, which we can talk about later, and bought 5 different types of Tazo tea and used 1 or 2 tea bags for 1-gallon batch. Mm. Let them sit for about a week until I thought the flavor was good. And this is what came out. So the first one is a Tazo tea called African Red Bush, which I chose for variety because this is one of those just really interesting tea flavors. I thought, well, heck, let's try it.
And remind me of the starting gravity of these.
These were starting at 11:45, ended up at 10:30.
Get quite a lot more heat
from
this one.
Yeah, it's a little more fiery. Mm-hmm.
There are no chemicals like you would find in compounds in the extract or in the vanilla to bring the heat off of the alcohol.
Mm.
So, in this one, you really, really taste it, the heat of the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But the flavor is there underneath the tones.
Mm-hmm. It's very subtle. Mm-hmm. These are more akin to our experimental mead batches. Ours are really hot.
Yeah.
Especially the first round, we started off with a lower gravity. The second round, we started off at 1100 and still sweeter, but not nearly as sweet as, you know, the first of your meads that we've tasted this evening.
Right. So the general consensus, and this is a general consensus and not meant to be scientific in any way, is that a sack mead, which is the sweetest meads, tend to be around somewhere between 1018 and 1025. And the first one that we tasted was like a 1050. So it was very, very, very sweet. These are sitting at 10:30, which is still considered a sack mead. It's just, unfortunately, the alcohol and the flavors are masking the sweetness. Now, you let these sit for another year, alcohol taste will be completely gone.
Huh.
Completely gone. The batches that I did from 3 years ago, when you tasted them at 6 months, it was like rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 3 years later, it's dangerous because you can't taste the alcohol at all.
Huh.
It hasn't evaporated out. It's just aged out.
Huh.
So in a year, you come back in a year to the next Homebrewers Conference, we'll listen to the podcast, we'll taste them again, and you'll say, oh my gosh, I can't believe that that tastes like that. It's the most amazing stuff. Time.
Yeah.
It's the most important element.
You would, logically, you would think that it would be the opposite, that you would get more alcohol flavor over time.
Absolutely the opposite. Hmm. In fact, one of the, if I remember my reading correctly, there is a mead in Poland that they age for 20 years before they release. So it's not a cheap batch, but apparently it's fantastic stuff. So the next one we'll try is the wild orange spice. So this has some orange tones in it. Again, another Tazo tea bag mead. And again, these are the same Tazo tea bags that you'll buy at any Starbucks or at the store or in some restaurants. It's the same Tazo tea.
And you're not getting any kind of endorsement fee from...
Oh, heck no. If only. And of course, my theory is that if you can make a tea with it, try it in the mead, you know? There's actually, I saw a recipe once for green tea mead. There's one also that I'm trying, and I want to formulate and spend some more time on, a chai spice mead. Mm. So that one's probably one I'll tackle someday.
Mm. Well, I haven't tasted this yet, but the orange notes in my nose are really nice, and it reminds me of the tea. I've had this tea, and boy, you really captured it. Mm. So now I'll taste it, and we'll see.
So I think about alcohol-soluble flavors that you're in cooking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very nice. I think I like this one better than the, what was it, Russian?
African Red Bush.
African Red Bush. Russian.
Certainly.
Jeez, I'm geographically challenged as well as...
Well, it's been a long week already.
Yeah.
So. No, that's very nice.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of anise in there, or anise, depending on... Who you mm-hmm. you know, kind of licorice kind of mm-hmm. flavor in that?
I thought anise was a girl that you dated in eighth grade.
No, yeah.
That's another story.
Oh, okay. It has a little of anise, and then it has a little of a nephew. So,
put him. You're a drummer. Where do we need a rim shot?
A rim shot.
I really enjoy this one. This is very nice.
And again, in a year, that alcohol burn will be gone, just completely gone. And that's the only one of the only downsides is the weight. You know, there's some bees, you know, if you make a lighter meat with less alcohol, the less alcohol you have, the less time it takes to age. Mm-hmm. The more alcohol you have, the longer time it takes to age. If you make a barley wine, mm-hmm. same kind of concept,
right?
You have to let it age out, and you'll be glad you did. The hard part is actually having the patience and the, what's the word I'm looking for, the discipline,
mm-hmm.
not to drink it all before it reaches that point. So that's always a challenge. So the final one of the clover-flavored batch, Tazo, is the sweet cinnamon.
Mm.
So this will be the final one that we have of this batch, and then we'll move on.
Kind of looking forward to the cinnamon.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, this is just clover, the regular clover traditional mead, flavored with Tazo tea bags. So nothing more spectacular than that. Of course, I always think simpler is better.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we will test that theory with one of my other batches we'll taste tonight. Because the ingredients list on that one is probably as long as my arm.
Send me goodness.
And the heat's present in this one as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to. There is a sweetness at the end that wasn't in the others. I'm just wondering what's in there with the cinnamon.
You know, I'd like to know that as well. They don't print the ingredients of the herbal blend on the side of the box.
So this reminds me very much, I don't know if you've ever had it, of Benedictine, the liqueur. I don't know if anybody's out there has ever had Benedictine. This tastes a lot like Benedictine to me, which is a liqueur made by the monks somewhere in Europe. And so it's got all kinds of secret herbs and spices, and this reminds me of it very much.
This is getting me close to where I think the Polish meats are. So, you know, there's I'm probably one of these days going to try a blend of the sweet cinnamon and the orange and put those together and see how they come out, just for the fun of it.
Are you detecting some vanilla notes at the end of that? Is that what I'm...
I do get some vanilla. And I get some vanilla. I get a little black pepper. Definitely a lot of cinnamon. And then some other things that I'm not sure about, you know. But definitely a little bit of vanilla and definitely a little bit of black pepper. It's good.
It's amazing how much the alcohol will bring out those individual those flavors out of those herbs.
Yeah.
And bring them back in. That's why I love this hobby. It's always a surprise. So that was the last of the clover flavor batch experiment.
All right.
All right. Moving on now. The next one is a traditional mead. This is just honey, water, and yeast and nutrients. Okay. This one was made using alfalfa honey. This was fined with sparkaloid again, but since it was a 5-gallon batch, it's much easier to rack off the finings. Now, one thing about sparkaloid is sparkaloid fining material is very, very, very fine. It's like a powder. If you use sparkaloid, the minimum wait time from the time that you put the sparkaloid into where you rack off is 4 months. And most people recommend 8 months. Because then I ran into it because I waited 4 months, and there is a fine layer of sparkaloid at the bottom of this bottle. Yeah. It's minute, but it's still present, and you know, you don't want that pouring off into your room.
Yeah, what exactly is sparkaloid?
Sparkaloid is another type of inert clay. Mm-hmm. It's more pure than the bentonite, but it's an inert clay. Finding agents work because they have an opposite charge as to cladding material and yeast. So when you mix it in, they attract each other and form large clumps, which then are heavy enough to fall out of suspension. So the sparkaloid is one of the more inert ones, and because it is an inert clay, it doesn't add any flavor to the mead, which is very, very important. So this one, again, just straight alfalfa honey, and I'm pouring it out of a graciously donated Redstone meadery bottle. And this is why I'm one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of Redstone, because by law, when they have a bottle that's been filled with commercial product, and then they empty that in their tasting room or somewhere else, they cannot, by law, put that glass back into rotation. Mm. They either have to recycle it, throw it away, or they do what Redstone does, which is they gather them up and they give them to homebrewers who come in and ask for them. So I take them home and I clean them up, take the labels off, clean them with Pro Brewer's Wash, and then I will sanitize them with the same sanitizing stuff that I use in my brewing, and then fill them up. So this is, as you can see, is very, very clear. I was very, very pleased at how clear that came out.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And then it's alfalfa traditional.
This is just nicely, it's just nicely balanced. I don't have a lot to say about it. It's a wonderfully honey tasting liquid that's just would make you really happy to drink some of this, you know, in front of a fire, and it's snowing and you've got a glass of this, and life can't get much better.
Good job.
So let me look at the notes on this one. This again started at the same point as the clover, which was 11:45. It ended up at 10:17. So this one is floating somewhere around 15%.
Wow. And how old is this one?
This one yeast pitched on August 8th, so we're now 9 months in. So you can the alcohol is starting to taper off. There's still a little bit of the bite, but again, in a year, there will be no bite, and all you'll have is honey and sweetness in this one. But even now,
yeah, the alcohol is not nearly as hot as in the others. Very good.
That's, to me, that's the way that a traditional mead should taste. Mm-hmm. All you're getting out of that is the honey character, the character of the alfalfa honey. And when you, in my mind, when you're doing a traditional, what you want to taste is the character of the individual honey that you're using. A lot of people will use orange blossom. In fact, the company that made the winning traditional mead of the last International Mead Festival, that's Rabbit's Foot down in California, made their mead from orange blossom honey. It was just straight orange blossom honey. It was 9%. And it was probably the most fantastic commercial traditional mead I've ever had. Mm-hmm. I have to admit. And but it sells for $50 for a 375 milliliter bottle. So,
well, yeah. There you go.
So I figured, well, let me make some of the local alfalfa. So,
as they say back home, they're proud of that.
Proud of that. This alfalfa honey is just delightful. I really like the taste of it. It seems to be a little. I don't know. I'm kind of hunting for words here. It's been a long day. It seems to be a little milder somehow and just easier on my palate than the clover honey. And, of course, we didn't taste just a straight clover mead.
Right.
So that's kind of not fair. But I really enjoy this honey, and I would look forward to making a mead with this kind of honey.
Now, I used clover for the flavor because at the time I only had a choice of three honeys. I had the alfalfa, the clover, and the dark wildflower. And of the three, the clover was the lightest of the three. So I used that to get the flavoring instead of the flavoring out of the adjuncts,
right,
rather than just having the honey alone. Now, the final one in the bottle is one that is probably what I would call my crowning achievement. So this is my Pinot Noir Piment. This is made with Pinot Noir, grape juice, water, and orange blossom honey. Now, as with most things in my mead, I try to make this as simple on myself as possible, and I think I've achieved that here. Instead of going out and trying to find Pinot Noir grape juice, getting the proportions right, and doing all this kind of stuff, what I did, I used a mead calculator that I got from someone who's now become kind of my default mentor on the web. And I went out and bought a Pinot Noir wine kit, which is a 6-gallon wine kit. So I mixed the kit all the way up to the 6 gallons, but stopped short of pitching the yeast. And what I did then is I siphoned off half of that, 3 gallons, into a 5-gallon carboy and made that as a straight wine. With the remaining 3 gallons, I added water and honey in the right proportions to hit 5 gallons. At the original gravity that I was trying to hit, which was 1120. So I used the calculator to determine how much water and how much honey I had to add to the gravity of the juice that was mixed, and I measured it. So I measured it, did the calculations, and then added water and honey to it to reach 1120, to try to reach 1120. I hit 1121, so I did pretty good. And then I used the yeast that came with the kit on the wine, and I used a different yeast on the piment. I used the RC212 yeast, which is typically used with red wines. It's a labeling yeast. And fermented this wet batch using that. And I did this as close to the wine kit instructions as possible. So I actually used potassium metasulfate, which is also called K-meta, and potassium sorbate to stop the fermentation at the desired gravity that I wanted. For the piment, I was going for 10-15. And I hit it with the sorbate and the K-meta, and then put in the fining agent that came with the kit. I bought the same fining agent from my homebrew store, put that in, let it fine out, racked off, let it sit for a month, just like the kit said, because it clears out even more during that time, then bottled. So this is actually I went with a higher end kit. So this is actually the grape juice for this one came from Oregon, from the Yamhill County region of Oregon, which is well known. And 3 months after I bought the wine kit, they discontinued the kit because they couldn't get the grape juice anymore. So we're hoping it comes back someday. And I think after tasting this, you will find that it will be well worth it if you do. Now, if you like red wines, if you like Pinot Noir, you're going to love this. I actually took this down to the homebrew store because when I mentioned to the homebrew guys that I was making this, their eyes got real big. And some of them thought I was crazy for using such a high-end kit. But once they tasted it, they said it was well worth the effort. So I'm very excited to share this. Like I said, this is probably my crowning achievement. So, cheers.
Cheers.
Mike, that's nasty. No. Sorry.
We don't want you to be harmed with this, so we'll just take it home and pour it out for you.
Yeah. We'll have to confiscate all the bottles that you have, and we'll take care of them at a hazardous waste facility.
I've got a hazmat facility in my basement.
No, this is very, very good.
Mm. Boy. Give me a rack of lamb. Mm. I'm in heaven. This is just absolutely delicious. I can still get some honey off of it. Mm. You know, it's very well balanced. Oh, boy. Boy, boy, boy. That's it. I'm done.
I was very, very pleased with this. I got the inspiration from Redstone. They also have a red pimate. Mm. And I was bound and determined to try to find a way to make one myself. Mm-hmm. And all I had to go off was the original gravity and what I wanted to hit for that and a final gravity. And I probably spent a full week agonizing over the measurements and the recipe for this thing. I actually added additional oak to it. It has oak dust that it comes with in the kit, mm-hmm. And some of the folks that I frequent on the forum said, you know, most of these kits they come lightly oaked. If you like oak in your reds, add a little extra oak to it. So I did. Agonized over what honey to use. I wanted something to bring honey character, but wasn't too heavy. And to have hit this on the first try, I think was just I was extremely lucky, and I'm very, very happy that it came out. I like the complexity of the Pinot Noir grape, and then mixed in with just the honey, which the orange blossom honey has a very floral characteristic to it, mm-hmm. And I think it came out very, very nice.
Yeah, I wish I knew more about wine to be able to contrast it with you know, with the straight wine.
Well, I could go down and get the bottle of the wine if you wanted me to open up the wine on the other side.
Well, this is definitely sweeter than a straight Pinot Noir would be, for obvious reasons. It's got honey in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even for people who really like very dry wine, so, you know, kind of the typical wine snob, and I don't mean that derogatorily, but descriptively. Mm-hmm. So unless it just makes you pucker up, it's not dry enough. I would think that people would like this because it's not that kind of cloying, cheap wine taste. This is much more sophisticated. I would be proud to serve this at any meal, at any time.
The Pinot Noir wine kit, when you ferment it out, actually ferments out to 0.996. So it actually comes out completely dry. Mm. So to add any extra sweetness in it, you would have to backfill with grape juice, or like me, add additional honey and water into it, and then stop the fermentation at the gravity that you want. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this one will enter a competition next year. Mm. I'm excited about the possibilities there.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. We've got some more.
We more meads or?
Yes. So if you want to follow me out to El Kegerator, there is some fantastic stuff to be had in the Kegerator. So
one more.
So welcome to my garage.
Yeah. And you have this thing in your garage.
It is a thing. It is a chest freezer that I've converted into a kegerator that mostly holds my beers, but also has a couple of meads on tap. Now, the one that we're tasting today, the reason why it's on tap is because not only is it about 18% alcohol, but it's probably got it has enough residual sugar to end up at about a 10.50 as well. 10.50 gravity. So natural carbonation is pretty much out of the picture. This one is called the Apple Butter Sizer. This is the most complex mead-type product that I have ever created. It starts out with a base of apple juice, to which we've added, for the original batch was about 7 gallons. So I took a 7.9-gallon bucket to ferment it on the, in the primary. To the 5 gallons of cider, we add 9 pounds of honey, 5 pounds of dark muscovado sugar, 2 pounds of dark malt extract, and 2 pounds of real apple butter. And once you get that all mixed up and dissolved, in the primary you have cinnamon and clove, and it's fermented with a distiller's yeast.
You'd pretty much have to.
Yeah. Once the and the original gravity was floating around 1175, so getting close to 1.2. Once it's finished fermenting, it goes into the secondary onto 2 pounds of white raisins for flavoring and nutmeg. Then it's racked off after that, sits for a month or so onto, into a tertiary to clear, and then mine went straight into the keg for cold conditioning and carbonation. This mead is closer to a liqueur than it is to a mead, so I warn you now. And we are going to pour.
And we're sipping in very small quantities.
Very small quantities.
There's that one.
In fact, about half of that for me, since I'm.
And it is carbonated to a certain degree. Now you're going to need to smell that before you try to taste.
Wow.
Sip lightly.
That's like a. An apple cobbler, or apple pie.
Yeah, but it's a lot more complex than that. I mean, obviously from the ingredients you listed. It also reminds me a lot of a really, really, well, of port. Mm. I mean, it reminds me a lot of port wine.
You know what it is. It's not apple pie. It's mincemeat pie.
That's it.
I got it.
You got it. That's right.
It's mincemeat pie.
I honestly did not know how this was going to taste when it came out. The people on the forums that have actually made it insist that if you can all at all try it to make it, the ones that that have tried it and made it say that they have to make a new batch every year because it goes so quickly. And you can tell why. This is a winter brew for sure. Mm-hmm. It's a holiday brew meant to be enjoyed around Thanksgiving and Christmas. Yeah. And it will warm you up.
Yeah. Wow.
In unimaginable style.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is just quite the accomplishment. You know, this is magnificent.
It's Homeric.
It's very good. Very, very good. And now we're going to take our meads that we brought for you to sample back home with us unopened. because they can't compare with anything that we've tasted here this evening.
Oh, no, every mead has its merits. And I'm actually looking forward to trying the Ancho Chili. Ever since you did that episode and you showed the Ancho Chili and put it in, I've been dying to try that mead. So.
Well. No pressure.
So I want to try one, but I want to taste it before I try them because Ancho Chili is one of those adjuncts that you just don't think of in the same sentence as mead. You have to try it to get your mind around it. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, thank you very, very much for your hospitality. And Tanya, thank you for your cooking the wonderful lasagna that's every bit as good as any of the meads that we've had this evening. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Mike, thank you again, and cheers to you.
Cheers. And it was a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for coming. Had a great time.
Excellent. Well, thanks again to Mike, Tanya, Tiana, and Jared for all the wonderful hospitality and inspiration. Mike is working on a massive yeast experiment, mead yeast experiment that I hope we'll be able to talk about in the coming months. Well, next week, our chat with John Legnard of Sandlot Brewery. We'll talk to John about what it's like to be a little experimental brewery connected to one of the big boys, Coors. Of course, we'll get some tips on brewing some tasty beers of our own. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop, where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In our first one, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And we do it in a non-linear way that'll let you choose from a selection of methods to do that. You can see a listing of fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online from us, and we'll pack it up ourselves. We've also got shirts and hats, including our Go Forth and Flocculate shirt out there. And as usual, thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are the Hookless Mystery 71 by 74 inch shower curtain, Sage, and Swissmar decanting funnel, 4-hole stem with stand. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we'll get a little slice of that action. We appreciate your support. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson down in Austin, who also did our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.